Good morning. Welcome here. For those of you who were not present last Sunday, we were looking into the genealogies recorded in first chapter of Matthew and the third chapter of Luke. There was a few of you that had said you'd be we discussed these and we noticed that they're not the same, and we are concluding that the one in Matthew is Joseph's line, and the one in Luke is Mary's line. And there was some of you that were going to go home and do some study up on that, and I'd just like to open it up now for that, or any other thing that you would like to mention or bring to our attention about the study that we had last week. Just while you think about that, I get these last week when Alvin was up here, I noticed that he was trying to find a marker that works and didn't find one. I guess the trustees aren't doing their job, so I brought my own. You're welcome to use them, Alvin, then. And anybody else, too, for that matter. Okay. Did anybody come up with anything? The other thing that some of you mentioned, you were wondering what I've got in mind, where are we going? It is true that there is places where we intend to go, but I would be overjoyed to go to places where I wasn't intending to go to. We're following the line of the genealogies of Jesus Christ. And at the beginning of the study, we had read the verses in Timothy and Titus where it talks about not giving heed to fables and endless genealogies. And nobody had an opinion on what those verses might mean. I was hoping we could get through these before you develop any strong opinions as to what they might mean, too. So, I believe that our genealogies aren't important, our personal genealogies, but I do believe that, in light of the scriptures, that the genealogy of Jesus Christ is important, was important. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be recorded here. I'll probably have to do a better job of informing you what we intend to look at, but I will do it now in case I don't remember later. There's a few things that I'd like you to think about. There is when the kingdom was split in two, to the south and to the north, right after Solomon's reign. I'll just find that verse quickly. First Kings 12, verse 21. There's a few verses there, actually, that I'm looking at. After Jeroboam had taken the northern tribes to himself, and Rehoboam was here in verse 21, I'll just read that. And when Rehoboam had come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin and 144,000 chosen men, which were warriors to fight against the house of Israel, to bring the kingdom again to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. But the word of God came to Shimei, the man of God, saying, "Speak unto Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and unto all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the remnant of the people, saying, Thus saith the Lord, we shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing is from me." They hearkened therefore unto the word of the Lord, and returned to depart according to the word of the Lord. God said, don't go and try to get the tribes together, because this division is from me. What is the significance of that verse where it says that God said, no, don't do that. This division is from me. We're not going to be studying that in detail unless somebody has something right away they want to say to that. You're welcome to. But we might leave it till next Sunday, but leave that up to you. First Kings chapter 12, verse 21, onward to 24.
Just a little note, in the David's day already, it was talked about Israel and Judah. There was already some thought there. I don't know exactly, but I do know this, that division within a culture like that, or in Israel and Judah, to have that divide and then have it reconciled hundreds of years later, that's pretty amazing. And it might have something to do with where we're going, I don't know.
I don't know that I have an opinion on the actual why of it, more than in Second Chronicles. In Second Chronicles, where Second Chronicles 10, beginning at verse 12. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king said, come to me again on the third day. And the king answered them harshly, forsaking the counsel of the old men. King Rehoboam spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men, saying, my fathers made your yoke heavy, but I will add to it. My father disciplined you with scorpions, so the king did not. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of affairs brought about by God, that the Lord might fulfill his word which he spoke to by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. It was prophecy that would be that way. I'm sure that there was God had a reason for prophesying that to begin with, and I'm not ready to comment on that. I just wanted to point out that it was prophesied, and when God prophesies something, it's bound to happen.
Okay, thank you for that. What was the difference between, from that day forward, what was the difference between the two, the south and the north, southern kingdoms and the northern kingdoms?
I don't know, but if I'm not mistaken, when you read all the kings, the Israel, which was the north, right? Was Israel north? I don't think there is one occurrence ever of where the Bible records where it says that he did which was right in the eyes of the Lord. And in Judah, there is. They didn't all do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. It wasn't that it was all good. But I think that Israel never had a king that followed after God, and Judah had kings sporadically that did.
Anybody else? I don't have the verse right in front of me now, but after that, the north refused ever after that to have a king out of David's line. They never had a king out of David's line. I should actually find that, but the north refused to be ruled by a son of David after that time. Been thinking of starting with going into the book of Ruth and look at the significance of that story, or if it is significant, what it is. Maybe we'll just recap a bit. Well, what do you know about the Book of Ruth? Let's start there. Just an overview of the Book of Ruth. Things that come to mind when you think about the Book of Ruth. We know it is. It was through Boaz and Ruth appear in the genealogy in the New Testament where we're reading. Well. I think we better read it, I guess. Abe.
One thing I think about, she was willing to forsake the culture of that she'd been with all her life and everything for the sake of being a part of God's people.
Okay. I'm not sure if I got everything. I was just so able to hear that. But she was willing to
leave her culture and everything to walk with God's people.
That's good. Well, we'll start at the front. Elimelech... In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land, so a man from Bethlehem and Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and his two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. There were two sons. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. There were Ephratites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpha, and the other a woman named Ruth. About 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone without her sons and her husband. So, Naomi decided to, she saw no future in the land she was in after her husband died, so she left after that. She decided to go back to Bethlehem. And she saw no future for her daughters at Bethlehem, so she asked them to remain in the land, in their own land. But they both started to go back with her. And again, she made an appeal. Verse 11, Naomi said, "Why should you go on with me? Can I still give birth to two other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? No, my daughters, return to your parents' homes, for I am too old to marry again. Even if it were possible, and I were to get married tonight and bear two sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? No, of course not, my daughters. Things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me." And then we have them. So she was saying, what was she referring to when she said, "Can I give birth to two other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? No, and even if I could, if I were to bear two sons, would you wait on them to marry them?" In reference to what was she saying that?
I believe she was referring to the, I don't know if it was a law, and I don't even, am not able to give much of an apologetic for it, or an explanation, but I think she was referring to the thing of a kinsman redeemer in Israel. When a husband died, there was the closest of kin was to marry his widow, I believe. Like I said, I don't know all the details, but I think that's probably what she was referring to.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's in Deuteronomy 25. Let's read that portion, Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10, if I could have a volunteer to read that. Whenever you see somebody, just go ahead and take the mic. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10.
If brethren dwell together, and one of them die, and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, and take her to him as a wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to raise up to his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come to him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done to that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that has his shoe loosed.
Thank you. Okay, so is it true that if she went back to Israel with Naomi, she would have to forsake her, she'd have to commit herself to the law of the Israelites? That was an underscoring theme here. You don't have to be afraid to expose your ignorance. I'm doing that all the time up here, so.
I believe that it was voluntary on her behalf to forsake her God and make her mother-in-law's God her God. And if that became her God, then the law became her law as well.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll skip on to chapter 2. Let's read the first 10 verses in chapter 2. If I could have two volunteers, one to read the first 5 and another one to read the from 6 through 10. Volunteer back there. Another one.
And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field, and glean ears of corn after him, in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, go, my daughter. And she went, and came, and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And her hap was to light on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and said unto the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered him, the Lord bless thee. Then said Boaz unto his servant that was set over the reapers, whose damsel is this?
Do we have another volunteer for the next 5?
And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, it is the Moabitish damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. And she said, I pray you, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and hath continued even from the morning until now, that she tarried a little in the house. Then said Boaz unto Ruth, hearest thou not my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence but abide here fast by my maidens. Let thine eyes be on the field, that they do not reap, and go thou after them. Have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee? And when thou art athirst, go unto the vessels and drink of that which thy young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said unto him, Why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou shouldest take now knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger?
Okay. So, what do we know about Boaz? Three things, actually, that we can learn from verse 1 of chapter 2 that he was.
He was in their family, and he was also wealthy.
Mighty man of wealth, and he was also a relative. Which gives him the... According to the law, it puts him in a position to be Ruth's redeemer. Okay. We will now read the first 13 verses of chapter 3. If I could have a few volunteers to read, maybe in 4 or 5 verses at a time, whatever. The first 13 verses of chapter 3.
Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young woman you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is widowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do.
And she said unto her, All that thou sayest unto me I will do. And she went down unto the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn, and she came softly, and uncovered his feet, and lay down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid and turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, Who art thou? And she answered, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thy handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman.
And he said, Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for in the city of my people, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman, howbeit there is a kinsman nearer than I. Tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of the kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of the kinsman to thee, as the Lord liveth. Lie down until the morning.
Thank you. So he, Ruth here made an appeal to her Redeemer, to her family Redeemer, that he would redeem her. He said, I'm willing. However, there's another one that is actually closer relative than I am. And he will deal with that matter, which he will deal with here in chapter 4. Maybe we'll read the first 10 verses of chapter 4.
Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, Turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, Sit down here. So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, Buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming, and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, Buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech, and all that belonged to Chilion and Malon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Malon, I have brought home to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses to this day.
Thank you. Okay, so we had another kinsman redeemer. We see three things that typify Christ in this story. There's three things that are needed for a redeemer. He must be related. He must have the means to pay. He must have the means to pay the debt, and he must also be willing to pay the debt. We had another one that stood in line because of being a blood relative, and very likely he had the means to pay the price, But he wasn't willing to jeopardize his own inheritance, it seems. In Boaz, we have all three. He was related. He was able to pay. As we learned, he was wealthy. And he was also willing to do that. And those are three things that Jesus Christ was also willing to do for us. Comments on that? When I see some brows furrowing, I like to actually hear voices too, so.
I just have a question in verse 6 of chapter 4. Then, like this Redeemer had already said, he would redeem the inheritance. He would take the land. He would buy it from Naomi. And it seems that as soon as he knew he would also be getting the widow, that is what suddenly made him realize that he could be jeopardizing his own inheritance. Why? I don't get it. I don't. Why is that? Why was he suddenly saying that I might impair my own inheritance on the strength of having to take Ruth as his wife, as well as buying land? He obviously figured he had the means to buy the land.
There's actually somebody raising hand. Can't get the wait to get the answer out. So,
well, just a little commentary. My Bible was saying that he may have feared that if he had a son through Ruth, some of his estate would transfer away from his family to the family of Elimelech.
Does that make sense to you? Can you probably need time to process that? But okay. Did any of you come up with anything you wanted to look into about the genealogies? In Matthew chapter 1, it starts in with Abraham, the son of Abraham, the son of David. Why is that? Descendant of David and of Abraham. Why does he start with those two?
Because both to both Abraham and to David, the promise was given that Jesus would be born of their lineage. First to Abraham, it was the promise was given to him, and then later on to David as well.
Okay. Does anybody know where those promises are found? Referring to David. There's a testimony of that. Where is the actual taking place of it?
I think perhaps in 2 Samuel 7. I was distracted earlier, so I'm not sure if I'm actually following in the same line of thought, but the promise of David being on the throne forever, I think, is found in 2 Samuel 7, if that's what you're looking for.
Um, I'm looking for any that anybody knows. That's one. There is another one in basically the same account in 1 Chronicles 17 or 2 Chronicles 17. I'm not sure right now. 1 Chronicles chapter 17. It's pretty much a duplicate of that. What about, that's one to David. Question first on this one. What was the promise that was given in this here chapter? What is the promise to David? Where do we see the promise that the Messiah would be built through his line? That the Messiah would come through his line? Okay, that's something we'll have to study. What about the one to Abraham? Where is the promise that the Messiah would come through his line?
There is the verse in Genesis 22, verse 18. After he has told Abraham that he would multiply his seed, then he says in verse 18, and in thy seed, Genesis 22, verse 18, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. So I see that as a promise towards the Messiah that would be a blessing for all people.
Okay. So, where God, in chapter 15, God made it's a record of a covenant that God made with Abraham. Verses 17 and 18. And so we read through Genesis, the promises to Abraham, we believe they are referencing to Christ. Is that legitimate to believe that? We're running out of time, and this is something that we'll look into next week. I'm going to make an absolute statement. I'm going to make a fairly absolute statement. And I do this realizing that any person that makes a fairly absolute statement is setting himself up to be proven wrong. And you might be like most other people. I like to be proven wrong. You might be like most other people and you'd find that surprising. Yeah, I do. Sometimes I just have more emphasis on the proven than people think I should. As we study, and I want you to think about this statement as we study the covenants, as we study the promises. Our God, and I'm going to write it on the board, actually. Our God is an eternal God who who makes eternal covenants with eternal things, which are covenants which are unconditional. Our God is a God who, in His great mercy, gave us, made temporal covenants to temporal things, to demonstrate to us of the need for an eternal covenant to eternal things. And I want you to think about that. I'm going to write that on the board. I think there's probably more I'd like to add to that. I can't think fast enough. I'm doing that by just what's coming to me now, but I wanted to think about that as we study.